Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, December 8th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Hospital CEO, Schott's mandate on hold. Meyer says MMH pleased at federal agency's suspension of vaccine order. By Stuart Doreen. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers said Tuesday that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has suspended enforcement of its vaccine mandate. And he's okay with that. The mandate would have required staff at healthcare facilities that participate in Medicare and Medicaid programs, like Midland Memorial Hospital, to be vaccinated. Myers said Midland Memorial Hospital officials had worked to develop policies related to the mandate and that officials had even considered over 250 exemption requests that were allowable under the mandate and granted the vast majority of those, so many of our employees would have been exempted had the mandate continued forward. We really didn't think that the mandate was accomplishing a lot, other than giving us some potential staffing challenges, Myers said Tuesday. As we've seen as the Delta variant has evolved and we've learned more and more, most people in our community are vaccinated or have had the disease. Vaccination is not a certain preventer of the transmission of the disease. It makes it less likely, but it doesn't eliminate the possibility of someone being a carrier and transmitting it. So, with the high levels of vaccination we had among our workforce, now estimated at about 78%, there wasn't a whole lot to be gained by vaccination mandate. And we would be very pleased to see that stay off the books. Myers said legal challenges, including one in Louisiana, caused CMS to back off on enforcement this week until rulings have made it through the courts. We have put a stop to any preparation activity for enforcing the CMS mandate, Myers said. He added that Midland Health is prepared should the appeals courts uphold the right of the federal government to mandate vaccinations to again implement these policies. He added that the hospital was worried about a loss of staff because of the mandates. There is not an insignificant number of people for whom this is a personal liberty question, Myers said. It's not a question of whether the vaccine works or not. It is a you can't tell me what to do question. And I think we were in a position to lose some important employees had the vaccination mandate gone through simply because of that stance. And given the limited value of the mandate, that was not a good trade. We certainly want to keep our people working and caring for the people we serve here in the community. Myers said the hospital did lose a handful of people because of the mandate, and that Midland Health had contacted many of those people to ask if they wanted to return, knowing there wouldn't be a mandate. Myers said Tuesday that there were 126 traveling providers, mostly nurses, working in the Midland Health system. Job openings, he said, are a reality for a larger healthcare provider in Midland. But there was relief that the Biden administration's mandate didn't make Midland Memorial's employment situation worse. Fortunately, we're not going to have to face that in the near term, Myers added. We've had a reprieve from that. They're very thankful for that as the hospital remains busy and we continue to need the staff that we have to care for our community. So everything is on hold with the vaccine mandates as of now. This article is entitled Wilson Takes Stand in Trial by Iris Foster, Reporter Telegram. Light has been a recurring theme for the prosecution in the state of Texas versus David Wilson. How much light was provided outside as officers responded to alarm call? How much light did defendant have inside his house as he traversed the living room? How did the beam of Officer Nathan Heidelberg's flashlight affect Wilson's vision and the officer's ability to see inside. Meanwhile, on the sixth day of the trial, the defense focused on the absolute absence of light. First thing, the jury saw 25 minutes of complicated animations of a nearly pitch-black house, interior and exterior, in a semi-darkened courtroom. There were seven components of the animation, all based on ESI's Manuel Meza Arroyo's 10 to 12 hours at the Wilson home on a similar night with light meters, specialized cameras, laser scans, and motion capture suits worn by his team to reproduce the actions of Amy and David Wilson, according to the interior cameras. Dan Kruger of ESI explained that there was a virtual camera in his virtual animation software that exactly matched the home's security cameras. The first animation video portrayed the couple walking back and forth from the children's hallway to their bedroom. The second was a composite of the three entrances to the home that were hooked up to the door open chime and the five entries to the yard. A top-down view of the home, which showed the number of walls between entry hall and closet, as well as the threshold of the front door, was the focus of the third animation. The fourth was a view of the outside of the home, and the fifth ended with the light shining in the defendant's eyes just before he pulled the trigger. The sixth animation involved officers as they stood on the front porch, based on the home's exterior security camera. And the final animation gave a close-up view of Wilson's sight lines, and lack thereof, from the moment he arose. The prosecution asked detailed questions about the data Meza collected to transmit to the animators. One point involved the tiny lights in the backyard spiraling down three palm trees. Meza told the jury that light was far enough out in the yard to prevent it from illuminating the rooms inside. He further stated that his light meter would not record anything from the master bedroom looking toward the children's hallway. It was that dark. He also stood by the claim that Heidelberg's LED flashlight of 800 to 1200 lumens first shone on the dining table before sweeping right and pointing to Wilson's firing position. District Attorney Laura Nodolf called the alarm expert Chris Russell as a rebuttal witness to confirm that someone had tried to access the cameras after the shot was fired. When asked why the defendant or Amy Wilson didn't grab a phone on the bedside table and check cameras first, he responded that if he was awakened in the middle of the night, he wouldn't reach for his phone first, but would greet whoever with a gun. He has a home security system himself, but says that there's a delay on phones, a small screen, and choppy images. The defense next called the defendant's wife to describe their life prior to March 5, 2019. She explained that she obtained a nursing degree, they married, and they were a team in the early days of David Wilson's career. They started with the Fuller lease, six stripper wells producing one barrel per day, and one employee, so on his days off, each took a shift checking the wells. David Wilson's day job was selling cell phones. Over time, they acquired other properties and were very blessed. He formed Unitex Oil and Gas, LLC, and first partnered with the late Ted Collins of Midland. Currently, he employs 80, overseeing 1,500 wells, is funded by the Ridgemont Equity Partners in North Carolina, and hired his father as field supervisor. Defense attorney Daniel Hurley walked her through problems with their alarm system, cell phones, and even Wi-Fi attributed to the home's metal roof. Then, he asked her to describe the events of March 5, 2019 from her standpoint. She could not comprehend that a door was unlocked because their habit was to lock each one after coming through. Furthermore, they rarely used the front door, so it was almost always locked. She said she had never before felt so panicked or scared because she knew the door open message wouldn't chime unless someone opened it. After her recounting of the events, which had been seen by the jury last week, the former home's owner, Mitch Clark, appeared. The former owner of Tomcat, a structural truss company with top entertainers as customers, explained that he wanted a dark and soundproof home, so he made several modifications to interior and exterior walls with foam and Tyvek, and channels on the side of windows to accommodate that. He also installed heavy, 9-foot stainless steel front doors with opaque glass inserts. He acknowledged that Eagle Cove cul-de-sac is very dark at night, with just one street light, and his house numbers backlit on a retaining wall. The day's final witness was the defendant David Wilson, a deacon at First Baptist Church, where the Heidelberg family also worships. He told those in attendance of his early goal to become an oil man, his interest in FFA and 4-H, where he met Amy, and his desire to teach his daughters the value of hard work by raising pigs in a barn they built on their 2-acre property on Eagle Cove. Hurley and prosecutor Andrew Vanderhoven repeatedly asked him why he got his gun and fired the shot. And he consistently responded that he was scared to death when he perceived a threat and that someone had opened the front door. He got the gun to stop people from entering his home and fired immediately at the flashlight. When asked how he would have acted, knowing what he knows now, he said, "I would have done anything to stop it. I didn't want anyone to die." This article is entitled ProPetro Assists Harmony Home. ProPetro Services employee-led PUMP, Positive United Morale Partners, committee organized donations to provide Thanksgiving meals for Harmony Home Children's Advocacy Center's 35 families. The employees of ProPetro answered the call and went above and beyond, which left the heavy haul department within the ProPetro frack department with excess funds. This department unanimously agreed to take the extra funds their department donated and fulfill the Christmas wish lists for the children of Harmony Home. In between jobs, the heavy haul department handled the shopping and delivery of more than 240 toys to Harmony Home Children's Advocacy Center. ProPetro, a proud supporter of this community, states it is thankful for its employees who make a difference in the lives of others. This article is entitled Officials: Parks Annual Costs Could Reach $5 Million by Stuart Doreen. The co-chairs of the conservancy that will operate Hogan Park said building an endowment will help with operational expenses that are likely to come up. Jeff Beard and Laurie Blong said during an online presentation about the park this week that $3 million of the initial $55 million raised will be used for an endowment, which will be used for expenses during the years following the park transformation. One such expense is the turf. For all the baseball, softball, and soccer/mixed-use fields, there will be turf, lots of turf. Of the total $53 million price tag for the Hogan Park transformation, $25 million will be spent on turf. That includes turf for the outfield areas, brown turf to be set where one would normally expect to see dirt on baseball and softball fields, and even turf in the dog parks, with a sprinkler system that will help wash down animal waste. The turf is expected to last 15 years and guaranteed for 10 years. Beard and Blong said the cost to replace turf is included in maintenance and operations budgets. They also expect annual budgets of around $5 million. Beard and Blong talked about several revenue sources to help pay for maintenance and operations for the regional park in Northeast Midland. Those sources include advertising signs on fences around softball and baseball fields, marketing and other naming rights opportunities like those taking place at the Scarborough Sports Complex, hotel-motel tax revenue, and oil and gas revenue earmarked for parks from the city. Another turf note will be what is not included on the turf on the soccer fields. Blong and Beard said there will not be permanent striping on the soccer fields because they want those fields to be used for other sports like football and lacrosse. Striped fields will be done specific to the sports being played, they said. Other notables from the presentation included, the color schemes of the facilities at the park will match what people see at Centennial Park downtown, the Tall City Brewery, and the Permian Basin Area Foundation building on Andrews Highway. There will be 7 miles of trails at Hogan Park when the park renovation is completed, including 4 miles around the entire park, including the golf course, and 3 miles of trails inside the renovated portion and trails inside the adjacent Sibley Nature Center. Pioneer Natural Resources has donated $2.5 million to the Hogan Park project, matching Diamondback's contribution. Beard and Blong said the pavilion that will serve as an entrance to the event lawn and splash pad will be called the Pioneer Pavilion. Over by the planned soccer/multipurpose fields will be 3 sand volleyball courts and 2 covered open-air basketball courts. The Barbara Culver Juvenile Center will not be moved as that would be cost prohibitive. Trees and berms will be used to help screen Culver from those at the park. This article is called State Briefs. It is entitled Texas to Appeal Court Ruling on Social Media Law. Texas plans to appeal a court ruling temporarily blocking a new state law that will bar social media companies like Twitter, Inc. and Meta Platforms, Inc.'s Facebook from moderating content to root out hate speech and extremism. Texas will seek to overturn a preliminary injunction against the law that was granted December 2nd in a lawsuit brought by a pair of prominent technology industry trade groups, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton said, in a notice of appeal filed Monday in federal court. This article is entitled Airline Releases Vaccine Numbers. About 93% of Southwest Airlines employees have either been vaccinated or applied for an accommodation from the company, a month ahead of the deadline set by the White House for federal contractors, the company said in a memo to employees this weekend. Dallas-based Southwest Airlines and other airlines are pushing employees to comply with federal vaccine mandate rules before January 4th, meaning they will need to be fully vaccinated, seek religious or medical exemption, or face termination. We continue to work through accommodation requests received and are pleased to report that the large majority of our compliant employees are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, Southwest Emergency Director Steve Goldberg said in the memo. This article is from the Dallas Morning News. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled Gas CEO, Regulations Holding Back Oil Supply by Alex Steele, Guy Johnson, and Simon Casey, Bloomberg. In the debate over why U.S. oil producers haven't added additional supply, the boss of ConocoPhillips lays the blame squarely with the government. An increasingly bitter war of words has developed between the Biden administration, which has called for more production to alleviate high energy prices, and an U.S. oil and gas sector that has kept output relatively flat while criticizing White House regulatory moves. There's no fast way to return supply, ConocoPhillips Chief Executive Officer Ryan Lance said Tuesday in a Bloomberg television interview from the World Petroleum Congress in Houston. But if you get a stable, transparent system here in the U.S. and manage through the uncertainties, then we will invest to grow, not at the expense of returns. But there is some growth that can come out of U.S. President Joe Biden campaigned on a pledge to ban new fracking on federal lands And more recently, his administration has focused on clamping down on the industry's emissions of methane, a far more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. The House Science Committee last week requested that Houston-based ConocoPhillips and some other leading U.S. shale producers share data on methane leaks. Lance said that's another example of unnecessary regulatory burden, and that in his view, the industry already is making strides in self-regulating when it comes to methane. ConocoPhillips on Monday announced a $1 billion variable dividend as part of efforts to return more cash to investors. U.S. oil and gas drillers are prioritizing returns to shareholders over increasing production. Investors have backed that approach after several years of poor returns, a period Lance said had been miserable for the industry. This article is entitled "Person Heckles Biden Official at Oil Conference" by Kevin Crowley. The Biden administration's number two energy official was heckled at an international oil conference after admonishing U.S. drillers to step up production in the industry's de facto hometown. Deputy Energy Secretary David Turk told shale explorers on Monday that the government already has done its part to lower fuel prices by offering up part of its strategic crude reserve. "Now there's needed leadership by our domestic producers," Turk said in opening remarks at the World Petroleum Congress in Houston. The reality is the Biden administration is not standing in the way of increasing domestic oil production to meet today's energy needs. His remarks provoked a heckler in the audience. "Why don't you help us then?" Turk, whose comments preceded presentations by the chief executives of ExxonMobil Corporation and Chevron Corporation, the nation's largest oil explorers, came on the same morning that refiners' bids for crude from the Strategic Reserve were due. The top 54 publicly traded companies earned over $30 billion in the second quarter of this year, slightly more than just before the pandemic, and production has not yet recovered, Turk said. This is the obituary column. Wednesday, December 8th. Betty Whitehead. Betty Lois Whitehead, 81, of Midland, went home to be with her Lord and Savior on Sunday, December 5th. The family will receive friends on Friday, December 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home, 801 Andrews Highway, Midland. A celebration of her life will be held at Ellis Funeral Home on Saturday, December 11th at 11 a.m. Betty is preceded in death by her father, Dr. James Huggins, and mother, Lois Hopper. She is survived by her husband of 35 years, Perry Whitehead, her four children, Lance James and wife Martha, Judy James, Jeff James and wife Tina, and Kelly James. Her four brothers, James Huggins, Richard Huggins, Ron Huggins, and Don Huggins, her 11 grandchildren and 15 great-grandchildren, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. Erin Sherry Taylor. Erin Sherry Taylor of Blanchard, Oklahoma, was born on November 23, 1978, in Pauls Valley, Oklahoma, to Steve Chambers and Nita Edwards Brosh. She passed from this life on Tuesday, November 30th, in Midland, at the age of 43 years. Survivors include her husband, Josh Taylor of Blanchard, parents, father Steve Chambers and wife Jamie of Mill Creek, mother Nita Brosh and husband Lindell of Marietta, sons Riley Taylor and Jaden Taylor, both of Midland, sisters Amy Shabester of Paoli and Shelley Mix and husband Jason of Burneyville, Amber Owen and husband John of Maysville, brother Michael Chambers and wife Crystal of Maysville, and numerous other relatives and friends. Erin was preceded in death by Lawrence and Winona Chambers, Sonny Edwards, and Billy Chambers. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, December 8th at the First Assembly of God Church, Maysville, with Reverend Bev Barker officiating. Burial will be in the Maysville Cemetery under the direction of John W. Williams of Winans Funeral Home, Maysville, Oklahoma. Words of comfort may be sent to the family at www.winansfuneralhome.com. Joe Flood. Joe Flood, 68, of Midland, passed away on Monday, December 6th, at home surrounded by his loving family after a fierce battle with cancer. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, December 9th at the Branch at Nally Pickle and Welsh. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, December 10th at Crestview Baptist Church in Midland and will be live streamed. Graveside will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Joe was born on June 18, 1953 in La Mesa, Texas to George and Joella Flood. Joe's life will be forever cherished by his loving wife of 29 years, Dana Flood, his devoted children Kay and Marcus Thomas of Broomfield, Colorado, Caitlin and Casey Peoples of Odessa, and R.J. Flood of Canyon. His precious grandson, Joshua Peoples of Odessa, brothers Tommy and Patty Flood of Midland, Benny and Pam Flood of Odessa, sisters Sandra Buckaloo of Midland, Kathy Flood and Stacy Alls of Alvarado, and Kayla Gillett of Midland, as well as many cousins, nieces, and nephews. Joe was met in heaven by his loving parents, George and Joella Flood, his friend and father-in-law, Clifton Gober, his big brother, Sam Flood, brother-in-law, Darren Gober, and sweet cousins and friends. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Every Life, Inc. to further their work in Kenya. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Nina Jones. Mrs. Nina Jones, 86, formerly of Snyder, died on Sunday, December 5th in Midland. Services for Mrs. Jones will be held on Thursday, December 9th at 10 a.m. at First Baptist Church, with Reverend Ben Reed officiating. Interment will follow at Snyder Cemetery. Services are under the direction of Belle Seipert Seal Funeral Home. Mrs. Jones was born on April 29, 1935, in Comanche, Texas, to James Alvin and Myrtle D. Hilliard Steele. She married James Oscar Jones on Sunday, July 26, 1953, in Comanche. He preceded her in death in 2015. She is survived by one daughter, Karen Sue Jones, and husband Chuck of Midland, daughter-in-law Nancy Jones of Snyder, one sister Peggy Mulhall of Groves, Texas, six grandchildren, and six great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her husband, James Oscar Jones, son James Kevin Jones, two sisters, Merlene Fagan, Nelda Chapman, two brothers, D.E. Steele and Theron Steele. Visitation will be held Wednesday, December 8th, from 6 to 7 p.m. at Belle Seipert Seal Funeral Home. Memorials can be made to First Baptist Church, 1707 27th Street, Snyder, Texas, 79549. Online condolences may be posted at www.BellCypertSeal.com. Death notices. Beverly Padgett. Beverly Padgett, 61, of Midland, passed away on December 5th. Services will be held by the family at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Gabriel Gonzalez. Gabriel Curtis Gonzalez, 36, of Midland, passed away on December 6th in Midland. Rosary will be held on Friday, December 10th, at 7 p.m. at Nally Pickland Welch Chapel. Celebration of Life will be held on Saturday, December 11th at 10 a.m. at Nally Pickland Welch Chapel. Garfield Wesley Bess. Garfield Wesley Bess, 85, of Midland, passed away November 30th. Viewing will be Thursday, December 9th from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. A graveside service will be Friday, December 10th at 11 a.m. at Serenity Memorial Garden Cemetery. He is survived by three sons, Wayne Bess, John Bess, and John Wayne Swindle. Two brothers, Stanley French and Lester Rollison Jr., several grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. Oscar M. Escontrias. Oscar M. Escontrias, age 76, of Borger, Texas, passed away December 4th. Visitation will be Tuesday, December 7th, at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. He is survived by his wife, Richard Escontrias, daughters Norma Arredondo, Rosa Madrid, and Maria Elena Carrasco, Juanita Ray, sons Oscar Escontrias and Ezequiel Escontrias. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Online condolences can be received at www.asanchezTFH.com. Sharon Janet Mays. Sharon Janet Mays, 67, of Midland, passed away Wednesday, December 1st. A graveside service will be Friday, December 10th at 3 p.m. at American Heritage Cemetery. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Sharon is survived by her daughters Sherry Webster and Shekia Coleman, one son Philip Coleman, partner Donnie Hicks, sister Pamela Jefferson, and two brothers, Gregory Webster and R.B. Webster, as well as seven grandchildren and a host of nieces, nephews, and cousins.
Good morning. My name is Jane Pellinghausen. I'm reading from the Health and Wellness section for Wednesday, December 8th in the MRT. This article was written by Val Sparks. MMH, respiratory disease on the rise. The weather is finally cooling off and activity is moving inside. The rise in respiratory diseases is impacting our community and the state. These diseases include influenza or the flu, respiratory syncytial, RSV, and coronavirus. The latest released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, FluView, for the week ending November 27th, are posted on the website cdc.gov/flu/weekly. Again, that is cdc.gov/flu/weekly. Seasonal influenza activity in the United States remains low, but in recent weeks, the number of influenza virus detections reported by clinical and public health laboratories has increased, and the percent of outpatient visits for respiratory illness has trended upward. Nationally, the majority of influenza virus is influenza A, or H3N2. Midland Memorial Hospital has expected a significant increase in influenza-like illness through our emergency department. In late November, the emergency department was seeing between 400 and 600 influenza-like illnesses a week, with only a few positive for flu. However, the number of RSV and COVID-positive patients are still significant and are impacting our inpatient census. RSV is a common respiratory virus that usually causes mild, cold-like symptoms. Most people recover in a week or two, but RSV can be especially dangerous for infants and older adults. RSV can spread when an infected person coughs or sneezes. You get virus droplets from a cough or sneeze in your eyes, nose, or mouth. You touch a surface that has the virus on it, like a doorknob, and then touch your face before washing your hands. You have direct contact with the virus, like kissing the face of a child with RSV. This virus is the most common cause of bronchiolitis, which is inflammation of the small airways in the lung, and pneumonia, which is an infection of the lungs, in young children in the United States. Midland Memorial has seen several hospitalizations, both children and adults, in the past few months due to RSV. Coronavirus continues to impact our community and our inpatient population. This, too, is a droplet virus that is spread the same way as flu and RSV. Testing to determine which respiratory virus you may have is important for the prompt treatment and avoidance of hospitalization. Testing is done with nasal swabs and several swabs, tests for different types of respiratory disease in one test, like flu A, flu B, RSV, and COVID. Treatment options for COVID include the outpatient monoclonal antibody infusion, which is now done in Odessa through the state-supported center. Influenza patients can be treated with one of four FDA-approved antiviral drugs recommended by the CDC to treat this flu this season. RSVP outpatient treatment is mainly supportive care to treat the symptoms. Medications for those hospitalized includes the antiviral drug ribavirin, steroids, and antibiotics. Recommendations to avoid all the respiratory diseases and stay healthy is to wash hands often with soap and water or use alcohol-based hand gel. Cover your coughs and sneezes by using a tissue or cough into your elbow, not your hands. Wear a mask when out in public or in crowds. Drink plenty of fluids and get seasonal influenza vaccine or obtain COVID booster if you are due. Val Sparks is the infection preventionist at Midland Health. Good morning. My name is Jane Hellinghausen. I am sharing an article from the Midland Reporter-Telegram on December 8th, the health and wellness section. The article comes from Midland Health. DAISY Award honoree Juanita Alcorn. The DAISY Award is an international nursing recognition program created to honor nurses who provide extraordinary, compassionate care. Midland Memorial Hospital is one of more than 4,900 healthcare facilities and schools of nursing worldwide that recognizes their nurses with this prestigious award. Anyone in the facility can nominate a nurse, be it a patient or visitor, another nurse, physician, or any staff member, anyone who experiences or observes extraordinary compassionate care being provided by a nurse. The DAISY Award honoree recipient is Juanita Alcorn, a clinical manager in the Midland Memorial Hospital Oncology Unit. Juanita was nominated by a cancer patient's family because they noticed that she, quotes, runs a tight ship. They recognize that she is the type of manager people want to work for. She is fair, tough, and has her staff's backs. She also deeply cares for her patients. Juanita took a lot of time explaining the pros and cons of treatments, the patient's son said. As this is his mother's sixth bout with cancer, getting good, solid, and medical information and understandable information is critical. Getting it from someone who knows how to communicate in these situations is priceless. It is because of Juanita's compassionate and caring efforts that her patients experience a level of care that exemplifies the impact nurses have in creating an environment where patients and families feel at home. Congratulations, Juanita Alcorn. Juanita is also previous winner of the DAISY Nurse Leader Award given out annually to one extraordinary nurse leader. Have you recently had an experience with a nurse at Midland Memorial Hospital? Please submit a DAISY Award nomination at the following link. https://www.midlandmemorialhospital.org midlandhealth.org/main/daisy-award-nomination-form. Again, that link is http://www.mildlandhealth.org/main/daisy-award-nomination-form.
This is Connie reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, December 8th, 2021. Emotional Testimony in Palvin Murder Trial by Michael Bauer. Emotional testimony of the aftermath of a double shooting in Odessa got underway Tuesday in the trial of Fabian Palvin, who is accused of gunning down his wife and her friend at an Odessa car wash in 2019. The trial would resume this morning at 9 a.m. in District Judge Justin's Lowe's 161st Court. A number of witnesses took the stand throughout Tuesday, including members of the Odessa Police Department. Palvin is accused of shooting two people to death back in November 2019, including his wife, Tiffany Nicole Palvin. An earlier Odessa American article reported that a probable cause affidavit detailed that a witness saw a white Ford F-350 pickup collided with a black Cadillac Escalade on November 26, 2019, that was parked on the north side of the Apex Car Wash parking lot located at 2357 East 8th Street. After the pickup collided with the Escalade, the witness said the suspect, who was later identified as Fabian Palvin, exited the pickup and walked to the Escalade and used a handgun to shoot 36-year-old Joseph Granada multiple times as he was exiting the passenger side of the Escalade. Video surveillance showed, after he shot Granado, that he walked to the driver's side and shot his wife through the door, which struck her several times. The affidavit stated that Fabian Palvin pulled his wife from the car and onto the ground and then left the scene. Lowe began the trial by asking the audience to keep emotions in check in order to have a proper trial. The defendant pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. The first witness called to the stand was Austin Aranda, who was working at the Apex car wash at the time of the shootings. Aranda testified that at the time of the shooting, he was cleaning the separators at the car wash and pointed out their locations on a map of the location and photos. Aranda said he saw the white pickup crash into the Escalade and started to walk over to try and help right before the shooting occurred. After the first shot was fired, Aranda said he ran back inside the building for safety and that he heard more shots while running. Aranda also mentioned that he tried to perform CPR on Granado afterward before he stopped responding. Granado was not responsive before the police showed up, Aranda said. Aranda said he did not know Tiffany or Fabian Palvin. Amber Carrasco was another witness called to the stand. Carrasco, who lived right by the car wash, told the jury that at the time of the shooting, she thought fireworks were being shot off before realizing it was a gunshot. She said she realized it was a gun that was firing after the second shot. Carrasco, who was emotional during her testimony, said that after the shooting, something told her to go over and check where she saw a man and a woman on the ground. She said she didn't see the gunman or anyone else in the white truck. Michaela Welch, who was working at Apex Car Wash at the time, along with Aranda, was also brought to the witness stand. Welch testified that at the time of the shooting, she was inside the office when she heard shots before going to the office bathroom to stay safe. Following Welch's testimony, the trial went on a 15-minute break. After the break, the trial resumed, where Pat Harris, who recently retired from the Odessa Police Department, was called to the stand. Harris was working as a crime scene technician and took numerous photos of evidence from the scene of the crime, including photos of the Escalade. Those photos were shown on the video screen in the courtroom during the testimony. After an hour and a half lunch break, the trial resumed at around 1:30 p.m. Crime scene technician Daniel Rudolph went over different photos of the scene after the shooting. Linda Hinojos, who is identified as Tiffany Polvon's cousin, was called to the stand during the afternoon. In an earlier Odessa American article, it was reported that Hinojos was contacted by officers and that she stated that her cousin told her that she was going to see Granado to give him a gift that she had made for him. Hinojos mentioned that Polvon had filed for divorce from her husband in 2019, and since then, Fabian Polvon had been threatening to kill her if she was found talking with other men, the affidavit stated. During Tuesday's testimony, Hinojos said that Fabian Polvon had told Tiffany 2 years previously that if he caught her in the other vehicle of another man, she wouldn't like what would happen. Hinojos was also questioned about a separate incident that happened in October 2019 at Stein's Bar that involved an altercation between Fabian and a few other people, including Abram Natividad. In Hinojos' testimony, she said that she and Tiffany Polvon were both at the bar playing a game of Jenga with Natividad and another person. Shortly after, Hinojos said that Fabian Polvon and three other people punched Natividad and his friend. Natividad confirmed the fight in his testimony and said that he did not know anything about Tiffany Polvon or her husband or who they were, as well as Hinojos. It was reported by the Odessa American that on November 27, 2019, Polvon's father, identified as Valentin Polvon Rodriguez, contacted OPD and stated that his son had contacted him and wanted to turn himself in, the affidavit stated. Rodriguez also stated that he had confessed to him that he shot his wife and Granado. More headlines from the front page. Sheriff gets 8 Dodge Chargers. Final version of county's redistricting map intact. By OA News at OAOA.com. Gaining a $302,600 county appropriation to equip 27 new Chevrolet Tahoe patrol vans, Sheriff Mike Griffiths reported after the commissioner's Tuesday morning meeting that he had also been able to recently buy 8 new V6 Dodge Chargers for his investigators and civil service officers. The chargers are all from donated money, Griffiths said. We may have had more donations in the last 5 or 6 years than we have ever had. The sheriff said his next goal is to raise $350,000 to replace his armored truck, because the one he has been out of service for some time and would not be worth repairing. Bought from Parkway Chevrolet in Tomball, northwest of Houston, the Tahoes were outfitted with laptop docking stations and input car adapters from GTS Technology Solutions of Austin, in-car camera and AED first response defibrillators from Axon Enterprise of Scottsdale, Arizona, and H2S gas monitors from Loaded Disc Safety of Odessa. Griffiths has said the Tahoes, financed with $2.5 million from the 1.25 cents rural sales tax that the voters approved in November 2018, would give him enough vehicles to let deputies take them home, enhancing the law enforcement presence in their neighborhoods and helping the officers respond to emergencies much faster. In other business, the commissioners formally adopted on a 4-to-1 vote a new redistricting map for themselves and the county's 4 justices of the peace. Having voted no, Precinct 4 Commissioner Armando S. Rodriguez explained that he preferred the rejected Plan A to the approved Plan B, both of which had been pro-offered by the Austin law firm of Bickerstaff, Health, Delgado, and Acosta to conform to U.S. Department of Justice guidelines. Rodriguez told Judge Debbie Hayes and the other commissioners before Hayes called for the vote that Plan A would have moved more minority citizens into Precincts 1 and 3 from his jurisdiction, which will have an 86% minority population with Plan B. Effective January 1st, Precinct 4 and Commissioner Don Stringer's Precinct 3 will expand west into Commissioner Mike Gardner's Precinct 1 because Precinct 1 had become proportionately overpopulated since the 2010 U.S. Census. Bickerstaff Health Attorney Claudia Russell told the court October 26th. Stringer's precinct currently has 32,457 people, Rodriguez's 36,596, and Gardner's 53,831. Precinct 2 Commissioner Greg Simmons represents 41,505, which is okay because the figure is within 1% of the DOJ, required 41,098, Russell said. The county has grown from 137,083 to 164,399 residents since 2010 for a 19.9% increase, she said. Precinct 1 includes western Odessa and the west side of the county, Precinct 2, northeast Odessa and Gardendale, Precinct 3, most of the city, and Precinct 4, southeast Odessa and the county's south side.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.